with you, you can download a reading app for your smartphone. And if you're too tired to read, I recommend downloading an audiobook on your phone. I can't tell you how many nights in the field I've fallen asleep listening to a good book. But please, download books only when you're connected to Wi-Fi. And do not, I repeat, do not watch Netflix, Amazon Prime, YouTube, or any video of any kind with the satellite sleeve attached. It costs us a fortune. I don't know exactly how much, but 2 years ago an EIS officer binge-watched some TV show and consumed tons of data. When the bill came in, someone from finance flipped out. They actually walked over to Elliot's office and threatened to limit our sat phone access or set a data cutoff threshold. It became kind of a big deal. Elliot talked him out of it, but we're still on probation. Remember, you watch Netflix, we lose satellite access, kids in Africa die. Got it? If you're connected to Wi-Fi, knock yourself out. Just not over the sat link. One last thing. We're going to Kenya to stop this outbreak. And part of the reason we've been invited to help is because a lot of brave, hardworking Americans went to Kenya before us and built alliances and relationships. Some of them still work for the CDC in Kenya, building those partnerships each day. We should all keep that in mind. This is a particularly critical time for CDC relations in the region. I spoke with Joe Ruto, the head of our office in Kenya. In early 2015, we discovered that millions in funds the CDC had donated to the Kenya Medical Research Institute, or KEMRI, had gone missing. An audit uncovered mismanagement and fraud by officials at many levels at KEMRI. With the money gone, thousands of good people were laid off. There were protests outside KEMRI for days. And even though the CDC had no financial oversight, many of the protesters and laid-off employees blamed us. This deployment could be a big step toward rebuilding relationships. Every one of us is a representative of the CDC and the United States of America. Our actions could impact our relationships in the region. That could have consequences for us, and for the people just like you, who will be on the next Air Force transport for the next outbreak. I'm not telling you to walk on eggshells or to be afraid to take decisive action, but if we can, we ought to do our best to leave our relationships there better than we found them. When the pilot announced that they were on approach for Jomo Kenyatta Airport in Nairobi, about half the members of the CDC team had surrendered to sleep for one last nap. The lights were dark in the passenger compartment except for a few glowing laptop screens at the back and several reading lights. Duffel bags and wadded-up clothes lay under the heads of those sleeping. Wool blankets covered the floor and were draped across team members. Peyton had fallen asleep on a row of five seats. When she awoke, she realized her legs were intertwined with the person sharing the row with her. She looked up and found Phil staring back at her. He sat up quickly, held his hand out, and pulled her up. They looked at each other a moment, then set about collecting their things and getting ready for the landing, which was surprisingly painless. She smoothed out her uniform, threw her duffel bag over her shoulder, and marched down the ramp off the plane. It was night in Nairobi, and beyond the airport tower, the city lights twinkled. A gust of warm wind blew a few strands of her shiny black hair into her face. Ahead, 12 Japanese SUVs waited on the tarmac. The front passenger door of the second vehicle opened, and Jonas stepped out. The look on his face stopped Peyton in her tracks. Something was wrong. Chapter 20. The black SUVs rolled through Nairobi, bunching up at stoplights and stretching out in between, like a black snake stalking through a field of skyscrapers. In the second car, Peyton rode in the back seat with Jonas Becker, her counterpart at the WHO. On the tarmac, he had told her only that he had urgent news to share. Whatever it was, he didn't want to share it in the presence of others. "How's the flight?" he asked.
"Good, long."
"You sleep?"
"A little."
"Sorry I woke you so early yesterday."
"Don't be. I needed the head start."
At the hotel, Jonas offered to carry Peyton's duffel, as he had a dozen times before. As always, she declined. The hotel wasn't fancy, but it was in a safe part of town, near the American Embassy. Kenyan troops stood guard in the parking lot, and Nairobi PD had several cars along the street. The moment the door to Peyton's room closed, Jonas said, "It's reached the villages." He spread a map out on one side of the queen-size beds and pointed to three highlighted areas outside Mandera. Peyton got out her laptop, connected to Wi-Fi, and pulled up the travel log from City Forge. "The two Americans videoed and posted their travel route," she said. "We should cross-reference to see if they visited these villages." Jonas ran a hand through his short brown hair and looked away, as if dreading something. Peyton was 5'6", and Jonas was only a few inches taller, putting their eyes on a near-equal plane. He leaned against the brown wooden dresser, searching for the right words. "What?" Peyton asked. "The American who first reported symptoms, Stephen Collins, died while en route. The British employee of the aviation company is also dead." Jonas paused. "And the other American, Lucas Turner, has now broken with a disease." It was Peyton's worst fear. It took her a moment to realize he had said "the disease" instead of Ebola or Marburg or yellow fever. "The Kenyan Ministry of Health sent a team yesterday. They've set up an Ebola treatment unit at Mandera," Jonas added.
"Have they tested anyone?"
"They've tested everyone. The Americans, the British man, and most of the villages. No one has tested positive for Ebola."
"What did they use?"
"Reibov. It's confirmed. We're dealing with a new pathogen here."
The Reibov antigen rapid test could show a false positive or a false negative in about 1 in 10 patients tested for Ebola. But across a large sample group, it was likely to be correct. The fact that they had all tested negative sealed the case. This was a novel infectious agent. Which meant Peyton's entire plan had to be thrown out the window. It was impossible to know whether ZMAP would be effective against the pathogen. Flying Lucas Turner back to Emory also presented a much greater risk if they didn't even know what they were bringing to the U.S. Jonas helped her bounce a few ideas around. They worked out a tactical approach for after they landed in Mandera, assigning teams to contact Trace at the airport and others to venture into the countryside to survey the villages. When they had a general plan together, they called the security advisors into the hotel room to get their input. Their Kenyan military liaison, Colonel Magoro, informed them that a Kenyan army brigade had departed yesterday morning for Mandera County and was already set up. The Kenyan government was prepared to quarantine the entire county if needed. The UN security officer reported that the African Union troops in southern Somalia had been alerted to the situation and were establishing checkpoints along the roads into Somalia. The Ethiopians were also in the loop and were taking similar measures. There were also two men from the American embassy in the room. One was a State Department official who listened to the security preparations, asked a lot of questions, and encouraged Colonel Magoro to bulk up the units that would be guarding Peyton's teams outside Mandera. The colonel granted the request without complaint. The other American introduced himself only as embassy security, and despite listening intently to the briefing, he said nothing. Peyton assumed he was CIA. As the men filed out of the room, he handed her a card with a number in Nairobi. "Call us immediately if you run into any trouble. We'll do everything we can." When they were gone, Jonas folded up the map and packed his things. Peyton thought he would leave, but he lingered, his demeanor changing, becoming a little more nervous. "You're going to miss Thanksgiving, huh?" he said. "Yeah."
"Parents disappointed?"
"Not really. They know I wouldn't be out here if it wasn't important."
"I know what you mean. You have a sister, right?"
"Yeah, older sister, Madison."
"And a nephew, niece?"
"Both now. Madison had her second child last year. A girl this time, Olivia."
He nodded, still seeming uncomfortable. Peyton was surprised by his sudden personal interest. Jonas had been a great partner over the years, but the relationship had remained strictly professional.
"What about you?" she asked,
unsure what to say. "No one missing me back in Geneva, or Heidelberg. Parents passed away a few years ago. I have a sister in London, but she's got a career and family, keeps her pretty busy."
He fidgeted with his bag a moment, then said,
"So no strapping young man counting the hours until you return to Atlanta?"
"No, not for a while."
Peyton looked around, wondering if he would say something else. Finally, she said,
"What about you?"
"No, me either. Kind of tough with the job.
I know what you mean. Jonas's mood seemed a little lighter, his nervousness gone. He put the backpack over his shoulders and walked to the door.
All right, then. Lock up tight. See you in a few.
Will do, Peyton said, watching him leave, a puzzled expression still on her face. She took a triangular wooden block from her duffel and wedged it under the door. Just in case, she also moved a wood-framed chair from the desk and placed it against the door handle. She set a can of mace by her bed and hid a sheathed boot knife under the pillow beside her. She assumed that the hotel washed the sheets regularly, but figured the comforters were rarely cleaned, just wiped off and left to collect all manner of germs and bugs from hundreds of guests each year. So she took the comforter off the queen-sized bed she would sleep in and placed it on the dresser. She definitely didn't want it near her face. Being germ-conscious sort of came with the territory in her line of work. For the first few years of her career, she'd done exactly what she'd advised her EIS agents to do. She'd called her mother whenever she landed for a deployment. As she'd grown older, she'd gotten out of the habit. But that night in Nairobi, sitting on the stripped bed in her hotel room, Peyton dialed her mother. Lynn Shaw answered on the second ring, and Peyton got the impression that she'd been crying.
"Everything all right?" Peyton asked.
"Yes, dear. Where are you?" Peyton told her, and they made small talk about the flight and her sister and her mother's quilting. After Peyton's father passed away, Lynn had raised her son and two daughters alone. Peyton had always been close to her mother, but that night, for the first time in years, her mother ended the call by saying, "I love you very much." When she hung up, Peyton wondered if her mother was sick. She got the distinct feeling there was a secret of some sort her mother wasn't telling her. For some reason, her mind wandered to her brother Andrew. He had died in Uganda in 1991 while working on an AIDS awareness campaign for the WHO and Ugandan government. On a hot summer day in August, he was working in a village in the eastern part of the country, inside Mount Elgon National Park, when a forest fire consumed the village, killing Andrew, his Ugandan liaison, and all the residents. They had to verify his identity based on dental records and personal effects. At the funeral on an overcast day in San Francisco, there was very little left to bury. Peyton was 13 then, and when the service was over, a woman with wavy blonde hair walked over and introduced herself, speaking in an Australian accent. She had been a friend and colleague of Andrew, and Peyton sensed that perhaps they'd been more. The woman reached into her pocket and brought out an item Peyton knew well. The silver pin Andrew had received a few years before at his medical school graduation, a gift from their father. The woman handed it to Peyton and said, "I believe your brother would have wanted you to have this." Peyton had turned it over in her hand, examining the serpent that wrapped around the staff. She was surprised that it wasn't charred.
"I thought it burned."
"I had it cleaned and refinished. I wanted you to have it in the same condition it was in when your brother carried it. All things can be repaired, Peyton. Some simply require more time than others."
On that shadowy day in August, holding Andrew's pin as the wind blew through her brown hair, Peyton knew for sure that she wanted to be a physician, and that she wanted to work in the field, helping people. Maybe it was because she wanted to continue Andrew's work. He had been both her hero and her father figure. Or maybe it was because she thought being an epidemiologist would somehow help her understand him, or bring her closer to him. But she was certain being a doctor was what she wanted to do, and she had never regretted her career choice since. She knew the risks, and they were worth it to her. She rose and set about getting ready for bed. She brushed her teeth, turned the shower on, and stripped off her tan service khakis. She sat naked on the closed toilet while she waited for the water to warm up, her mind focused on her upcoming decision. Lucas Turner, the 22-year-old American. Peyton wondered if he would be alive when she reached him. If so, what sort of shape would he be in? Would ZMAP be effective against the unknown viral hemorrhagic fever? Could it possibly make him sicker? And with or without ZMAP, would Lucas survive the trip to America? That was, if she followed the original plan she'd discussed with Elliot, the plan the director of the CDC had approved. That plan had been based on certain assumptions. And in the past hour, those assumptions had changed. The pathogen wasn't Ebola. Emery had the advanced medical assistance Lucas needed, But if they flew him to Atlanta, she would be bringing an unknown, deadly pathogen into the United States, putting 300 million lives at risk, all to save one young man. But if she left Lucas in Africa, he was, for all intents and purposes, on his own, left to fight off the infection or die, and that didn't sit right with Peyton. In the steam-filled bathroom, a plan began to take shape in her mind. Day 3. 32,000 infected. 41 dead. Chapter 21. Reuters News Alert. Authorities in Hong Kong and Singapore have issued an entry ban on anyone arriving with symptoms of an unidentified respiratory disease. Members of each government, speaking on the condition of anonymity, said that the disease in question is not another outbreak of SARS, but instead a contagion believed to be more flu-like and persistent in nature. It is unknown how many people are infected in either city at this time. Chapter 22. At 5 a.m., Peyton, Jonas, and their teams loaded onto the Air Force transport and departed Nairobi for Mandera. The air ambulance and a Kenyan Air Force transport followed along. The passenger compartment in the U.S. Air Force transport was cramped. In total, 78 members of the combined team sat in chairs, on the floor, and against the walls. Some of the young men took turns standing and sitting while Peyton and Jonas carried out the briefing, giving the integrated teams their assignments. When they landed, the sun was rising over the rocky, barren hills surrounding the airport. A convoy of military trucks with canvas backs sat waiting for them. Dr. Phil Stevens led the team that would be interviewing the airport's employees, building a timeline and contact tree for the British radar technician. After Colonel Magoro had joined them, Kenyan army troops offloaded their gear and drove Peyton, Jonas, and their team quickly through Mandera. The ride across the streets of hard-packed dirt was bumpy and dusty. Through the red clouds billowing at the back of the truck, Peyton got a hazy view of the rural town. She saw mostly single-story buildings arranged in a haphazard grid. They spread out from Mandera Road, the main thoroughfare that ran through the center of town. Livestock wandered the streets, cattle, camels, and goats, driven by ranchers bringing them to market. Residents pushed single-wheeled carts loaded with produce. Kids stood on every block, gawking at them as they passed, many pausing soccer games to watch. Their local guide shared some background on Mandera. It was the poorest of Kenya's 47 counties. Education was ranked at the bottom. There were 100 students for every teacher. Healthcare facilities were the worst in the country. Mandera's residents were largely subsistence farmers and ranchers. The economic situation was dire. In 2013, the Kenyan government had begun a process of devolution, handing much of the governing power in Mandera down to the county government. With the help of non-governmental organizations like the Red Cross and the UN, as well as support from the Kenyan government, the county had started turning its situation around. They had embarked on several large public works projects, including upgrading the airport and building a new government complex, a stadium, and an international livestock market. The convoy passed several of these projects, which were still works in progress. The airport and the new governor's mansion seemed to be the only completed facilities. The government had also updated and repaired Mandera Referral Hospital. The improvements had bolstered patient safety immensely, although the local terror attacks and recent payment problems had set their progress back. The county had also acquired its first ambulance and had contracted with the Red Cross for 7 more. But on the whole, the hospital was still a far cry from what administrators wanted for their county and their people. Peyton listened intently to the story of a county that was making its best effort to improve the situation for its people. The outbreak had come at the worst time. The convoy stopped at Mandera Referral Hospital, which was centrally located. 2 bus stops were nearby, as were the town hall and post office. The facility itself was a collection of run-down single-story buildings connected by breezeways. A wooden sign painted blue with white letters hung over the courtyard entrance. The Kenyan Ministry of Health had sent in a team shortly after the outbreak was reported, and they had brought with them a military escort to protect their team from Al-Shabaab terrorists. and to prevent local residents from entering the hot zone. From the looks of it, the Kenyans had done an excellent job. Army troops and PPE patrolled the perimeter, assault rifles at their sides. To Peyton, the place looked more like a prison than a hospital, but she knew this was for the best, as it would keep the uninfected far away. The Kenyans had set up a tent complex just outside the hospital, and Peyton and Jonas made their way there. At a long folding table, the head of the Kenyan Ministry of Health's mission, Nia Okeke, gave her report. She was a little older than Peyton, her black hair slightly graying at her temples. She spoke without emotion, describing the situation succinctly. Peyton was impressed with how much the Kenyans had done in such a short amount of time. On whiteboards that lined the walls of the tent, contact trees spread out in blue and red ink. Maps were marked. Numbers were tallied with times beside them. When Nia finished her briefing, Peyton asked to see Lucas Turner.
"Of course. And there is someone else I believe you should also speak with," Nia said.
Peyton suited up, doused her PPE with chlorine, and headed toward the hospital. Jonas was close behind her, as was Hannah Watson, a physician and first-year EIS agent. Peyton had never worked with Hannah during a deployment, but in reviewing her file, she had learned that the young physician hoped to work as a field epidemiologist for the CDC after her EIS fellowship. Peyton didn't envy what Hannah was about to go through. She could remember her first deployment, similar to Mandera. She figured every field epidemiologist did, but it had to be done. Hannah had to learn, and reading and classroom instruction could only take her so far. She needed field experience, and Mandera was the perfect opportunity. Peyton allowed Jonas to enter the hospital ahead of them.
"You clear on what you're doing?"
Peyton asked Hannah, who held a refrigerated box at her right side. The young physician nodded. Through the clear plastic goggles, Peyton could already see the drops of sweat forming on her strawberry blonde eyebrows.
"If you get too hot or need a second, just walk outside and breathe. If you need to take a break, don't hesitate. There's nothing wrong with stepping back for a minute."
Hannah nodded again, and Peyton thought she saw some of the tension drain out of the young physician. She hoped so. Inside the suit, Hannah could feel her entire body starting to sweat. It felt twice as hot inside the hospital as it had outside. Nia led the three of them, Peyton, Jonas, and Hannah, to a large room where at least 40 patients lay on mats, blankets, and pillows on the floor. Hannah felt her pulse accelerate. She had seen pictures of Ebola treatment units, but they hadn't prepared her for this moment. Time seemed to stand still as every detail leapt out at her. Plastic buckets labeled for vomit, feces, and urine lined the narrow walkways between the makeshift beds. Empty bottles of ORS were strewn across the floor. The buzzing ceiling fans fought a futile battle with the heat that seeped through the closed windows and rose from the bodies on the floor. Jaundiced eyes turned to stare at the newcomers. With each step, the thin rubber suit seemed to collapse in upon Hannah like a plastic bag whose air was being sucked out. The sensation of the PPE clinging to her sweaty forearms and thighs only reminded her that the thin layer was all that separated her from the pathogen that was killing these people. Any break, even the smallest tear, could let the pathogen in. She could be infected, relegated to fighting for her life in this place. She could hear her own breathing inside the suit. Outside, she heard the moans and crying of the patients. But amid the sounds of agony, a beautiful sound cut through. Singing. Groups and clumps performed church hymns and folk songs. The contrast of pain and beauty and courage was inspiring and unnerving. The box Hannah carried had seemed light at first. Now it felt like an anvil. She set it down next to a young woman lying in the corner.
"I'm Dr. Hannah Watson. I'm with the CDC. I need to take a small sample of your blood for testing."
The woman slowly opened her yellow, bloodshot eyes, but said nothing. A black fly landed on her face, causing her to turn her head, sending the insect back into the air. Hannah drew out the Re-Ebov test kit, took a drop of blood from the woman's finger, and placed a small bandage over the place she had pricked. She slipped the sample in the cooler and lifted the bottle of ORS by the woman's side. It was half full.
How many bottles have you been drinking per day? Hannah asked. The woman just shook her head.
You need to stay hydrated. Can I get you anything else?
After a labored breath, the woman said,
No, doctor. Thank you.
Glancing around, Hannah noticed that on one wall, someone had written the letters A through F to mark the rows, and along another wall, the numbers 1 through 12 marked the columns. She made a mental note that A1 was not taking enough fluids and that she had no other requests. She took out another test kit, lifted the cooler, and moved to A2. 20 minutes later, Hannah exited the hospital. She was so hot, she felt like clawing the PPE off. It clung to her sweaty skin, a hot plastic film that felt like it was melting onto her. But Dr. Shaw's warning was fresh in her mind. She took her time doffing the suit, then hurried into the tent, where an EIS agent was testing her samples from row A. The agent looked up. All negative for Ebola. Hannah nodded. Dr. Shaw had told her to expect that. But even though the Kenyans had already tested the patients and found them negative for Ebola, the prudent course of action had been to run their own tests with kits from another manufacturing batch, just to be sure. Hannah also knew that Dr. Shaw had likely planned this as part of her training. Hannah would be testing more patients in the field soon, in the villages around Mandera. She'd be on her own. And she was thankful for the opportunity to learn the procedure here, where she had help close by. Nia led Jonas and Peyton to the back corner of the large treatment room, where a middle-aged man was propped against the yellowing plaster wall. His eyes were closed, and he wore a sweat-soaked tank top. A folded white coat lay by his side.
Doctors Shaw and Becker, this is Dr. Elim Kibit, chief of physicians here at Mandera.
Dr. Kibit opened his eyes, looked up at his visitors, and wiped the sweat from his forehead. He smiled weakly.
In the interest of full disclosure, I was the only physician here at Mandera.
He focused on Peyton.
We did everything we could for the young Americans. I'm sorry. It was not much.
Peyton squatted down, bringing herself close to eye level with the doctor. All of us appreciate your efforts, Dr. Kibit. The CDC, the American government, and especially those boys' parents. Dr. Kibit reached under the white coat and brought out a spiral-bound notebook. He handed it to Peyton.
Before the ministry arrived, I talked at length with Mr. Turner.
Peyton ensured her gloves were dry, then flipped through the notebook, scanning the ruled pages filled with neat handwriting. Dr. Kibit had been extremely thorough. Peyton hoped his notes might contain a clue that would lead them to the index case.
Thank you, doctor, she said.
She looked up at Nia, who was studying her intently. Peyton got the impression there was something more going on here, but she wasn't sure what.
Are you ready to see Mr. Turner?
The Kenyan woman asked. Inside the orange Tyvek suit, Peyton felt as though the temperature had suddenly increased 5 degrees. She was aware of her breath and of the weight of the decision she would soon have to make. It was a call that could determine the fate of the young man, and possibly millions of others. Chapter 23 Lucas Turner felt like he had been in the hospital room in Mandera for years. He knew it had only been a few days, but those days had been the longest of his 23 years on Earth. The disease had started with a pain in his neck and a fever. It felt fine otherwise. But a few hours later, his body was turning itself inside out. He vomited nearly everything he ate. The diarrhea emptied his bowels the moment any morsel reached them, then reached for more, like a hose sucking his insides out. He was weak and constantly tired. It was impossible to concentrate. He drifted in and out of sleep, never knowing if it would be night or day when he awoke. He drank the rehydration salts, which grew more heinous with each bottle. He had no appetite, but at Dr. Kibbett's insistence, he forced himself to eat. He dreaded it. He knew his body would reject the nourishment in some way. He felt like he was fighting a losing battle, his own body now set against him. The smell of chlorine in the small room was overpowering. Dr. Kibit had left several paperback novels and a Bible by his bed, but he couldn't muster the energy to read them, despite his boredom. His thoughts were of his parents and his sister. They would be devastated,
At one point he wished he had never come to Africa. He cursed himself for being so naive.
Dreamers die foolish deaths.
He was instantly ashamed of the thought. He refused to live his life that way, with regret, second-guessing himself. He had followed his dream. It had led here, and that was that.
Life is uncertain. In the end, we control only a single thing, our own thoughts.
He set his mind to controlling those thoughts. He would stay positive, even if it was his fate to die here in this place. At some point, when exactly he didn't know, Dr. Kivett stopped coming to his room. There were new personnel in better containment suits. They were extremely cautious with him. Unlike Dr. Kibbet, they asked him no questions and never stayed in the room a second longer than they had to. Dr. Kibbet had treated him like a human being. These people treated him with clinical detachment. The sun was setting. Through the narrow window, Lucas saw a group of the new personnel gathered around a bonfire, tossing their suits upon the blaze. The fire belched heavy black smoke, releasing plumes as more rubber shells were piled onto the inferno. He turned to the small mirror on the wall, which reflected bloodshot, watering eyes and pale skin. It was the face of a stranger, a monster. With Jonas close behind her, Peyton followed Nia into Lucas Turner's patient room. Lucas was asleep, and Peyton hated to wake him, but it had to be done. The clock was ticking, and they needed answers if they were to have any chance of stopping the pathogen's spread. Nia reached out to shake the young man, but Peyton placed her hand on the woman's shoulder and moved in front of her. She sat on the edge of the bed, clasped Lucas's hand, and gently shook his forearm and said his name until his yellow-tinted, bloodshot eyes opened. Peyton forced a smile. Seeing this young American in the prime of his life so sick broke her heart. He had come here to try to make the world a better place, and that path had led him here, to this room, where he was dying. Lucas looked down at her hand holding his, seeming surprised that she was touching him. Peyton knew he was scared and had probably been treated with an abundance of caution, and rightly so. Still, it always amazed her how humanizing a touch could be. Seeing the hope that formed in his eyes at that moment made her proud of the work that she did, and more sure than ever that she was exactly where she was supposed to be, doing what she was meant to do. She leaned closer and spoke softly.
Lucas, can you hear me?
He nodded.
My name is Peyton Shaw. I'm a doctor with the CDC. We're going to do everything we can to help you, okay?
Thank you, Lucas said.
The words were barely audible. Peyton picked up the bottle of ORS from the side table.
Drink a little. I know it tastes bad.
She held it to his mouth, and Lucas drank, wincing slightly. She set the bottle back on the table and waited for him to swallow.
I read in Dr. Kibbett's notes that Stephen got sick about 7 days ago. Can you tell me where you all were then?
Lucas closed his eyes, trying to think. He shook his head.
I'm sorry. The days run together.
That's okay. Can you remember the last time you two were healthy? Maybe a time when you were happy?
A moment later, he said,
Mount Kenya, in the park.
What happened there? Did you come into contact with any animals? A bat? Maybe a monkey?
No.
He paused.
No, definitely not. It was our last stop before going to the villages.
He smiled.
We had barbecue and beer.
Peyton bunched her eyebrows up.
A local barbecue? What kind of meat was it?
No. North Carolina barbecue from home. And local beer, brewed in Raleigh.
How?
A package from a sponsor.
A sponsor?
Icarus Capital. Desmond Hughes. He's on our board.
Peyton stopped cold. The idea that Desmond could be involved both shocked and scared her. She was reminded of his words from the call. I think you're in danger. She tried to keep her voice even.
Was anything else in the package?
Yeah, the food was just an extra. Mainly he was shipping us our video cameras. We had decided not to bring them in our airport luggage in case they got stolen along the way. Plus, we didn't want to have to lug them around until we were ready to go into the villages. We weren't even sure how many we needed. Desmond offered to ship them to us when we reached Mount Kenya. He sent the package to the lodge where we were camping. The barbecue and beer was unexpected. Desmond's note said, good luck, and here's a taste of home.
That was it? Peyton asked. Cameras, barbecue, and beer?
Yeah.
Lucas held a shaky hand up and massaged his throat. Peyton again brought the ORS bottle to his lips and let him drink a bit. How is Desmond Hughes involved in your company?
He's an investor, Lucas said, his voice a little clearer. We only met him a few times. He's a technology investor and philanthropist. Kind of intense, really smart, into some crazy stuff.
Like what?
Change the world type projects. Everything from AI to medical research to quantum physics. He said the only thing humanity hasn't upgraded is itself. He thinks it's time.
He said the next version would be a quantum leap forward.
He was even using himself as a guinea pig.
Why was he interested in City Forge?
He said building better cities was the third world's only chance.
Chance of what?
Surviving.
That got Peyton's attention.
Surviving?
His words, not mine. He believes if the third world doesn't catch up to the rest of the world, there'll be a major catastrophe, an extinction-level event. He said that's why our work is so important.
Interesting, Peyton said. Why does he think that?
The absence of space junk.
Space junk?
Probes from other civilizations. This was over dinner, so maybe he was drunk.
Lucas thought for a moment.
Actually, I don't think he was drinking. Anyway, he said that the most disturbing revelation in human history is the existence of two seemingly impossible facts. One, that the universe is billions of years old, and two, that the moon is not covered with wrecked space probes from other advanced civilizations that came before us.
Peyton was confused. How is any of that related to an impending extinction-level event?
I don't know. He said he and a small group of people knew the real truth about why there's no space junk. He said they would soon test their theory. He was pretty cryptic about the whole thing, to be honest, and I guess we were sort of blown away by him, so we weren't really asking a lot of questions. He's kind of larger than life, and his check for $150,000 cleared, so, you know, we listened and nodded.
He paused.
Why all the questions about Desmond? Is he somehow connected to this? Is he sick?
Not that we're aware of, Peyton said, deep in thought.
Was the food contaminated? Are people back in North Carolina infected?
No, Peyton said. We still believe this is an isolated outbreak. I'm just covering all the bases. Listen, you've been very helpful, Lucas. I'll be right back, okay? Outside the hospital, Peyton, Jonas, and Nia washed off their suits and carefully doffed them. They entered the next tent, where Peyton pulled off her soaking t-shirt and toweled the sweat from her body. When she looked up, she saw Nia, standing naked as well, her body still coated in sweat, staring at her. Jonas was turned away, avoiding looking at the two women as he slipped on dry clothes.
Are you going to administer Z-Map to Mr. Turner?
Nia asked. She stared at Peyton without blinking. Peyton returned her stare.
Maybe. I'd like doses for Dr. Kibbitt.
In that moment, Peyton realized why the Kenyan Ministry of Health official had insisted she meet Dr. Kibbitt. It was already difficult to deny treatment to a person in need, and even harder when you had met the person.
I can't. I will give him the dose myself. I only ask for the medication that might save his life. If we cannot save him, or at least do everything we can for him, it will be difficult to ask others to put themselves in harm's way. It is also the right thing to do for a man who has put himself at risk long before your fellow Americans appeared at his door.
Peyton pulled on a dry t-shirt.
I'll have to make a call.
She walked away before Nia could speak again. Inside the main tent, she found Hannah, who sat at a long table typing on a laptop. The young physician stood when she saw Peyton.
Do you have the results?
Peyton asked. Hannah nodded.
All negative for Ebola. I took blood and saliva samples as requested.
Good. I'll be right back. Get the samples ready for transport. It was 8:37 a.m. in Mandera, 12:37 a.m. in Atlanta. Peyton slid the sat sleeve onto her phone and dialed Elliot Shapiro. She hated to call him so late, but it had to be done.
Yeah?
Elliot said, half asleep.
Sorry to wake you.
Peyton heard him rustling out of bed,
his feet pacing across the floor, a door closing.
It's okay. What's up?
His voice was still low. It's not Ebola. The Kenyans tested everybody, so did we.
Symptoms?
He asked. All the classic symptoms of a filovirus. If I didn't have the results, I'd say it's Ebola or Marburg. But this thing moves faster than Ebola. Mortality rate looks to be high. No one has survived yet. Elliot waited. Peyton tried to keep her voice even, professional. Stephen Cole is dead. Lucas Turner is infected. His condition is critical. The steadiness seeped from her voice with the last words, and she took a breath. This kid is dying, Elliot.
What do you want to do?
I want to give him Z-Map and fly him back to Emory. It's what I would do if he were my son. But it's not Ebola. We don't know if Z-Map will even help him, and we could be putting the entire continental U.S. at risk.
And?
And we might save his life, and figure out what this pathogen is, and help find a vaccine or treatment.
Exactly, Elliot said.
It's a bureaucratic nightmare.
You put him on a plane and focus on your job out there. I'll deal with the bureaucrats. That's my job now.
All right. There's one more thing. The Kenyans have asked for doses of Z-Map to administer to a physician here in Mandera.
How many doses do you have?
Enough for 12 patients.
That's tough, Elliot said. I want to say yes, but we may need the drug for our people if they get sick. We can't make this stuff overnight.
I agree.
On the other hand, if we end up flying out of there with one dose left, we may have sentenced a man to death needlessly.
Yeah, it's almost a no-win.
Do what you think is right, Peyton. I'll back you either way.
God, you're no help. I was hoping you'd make the call.
Making big decisions is part of your job, young lady, and those decisions are going to get bigger soon. I'm not going to be around forever. You're going to have to run this place when I'm gone.
I don't want your job.
Too bad. I'm going to insist they give it to you.
Then I'm going to retire.
That's the emptiest threat I've ever heard. You're doing exactly what you were meant to do. Text me when you put the kid in the air. I'll work on getting more Z-Map.
Back in the main tent complex, Peyton found Nia talking to three Kenyan government employees, pointing to the map and arguing. The tall black woman fell silent and straightened as Peyton approached. We'll give you doses for one patient, Peyton said, on the condition that the Ministry of Health provides us with a waiver that says the medication is for research purposes only and will be used at the Kenyan government's sole discretion. The CDC has no knowledge of what will happen to the doses, and we make no commitment to provide further doses. Nia shook her head.
We don't have time for paperwork.
Then I suggest you make the call now. I doubt you'll have any issues. I found you to be very persuasive. Peyton retrieved a dose of Z-Map from their supply crates, suited up again, and returned to Lucas's room. She knelt beside him. Hi, Lucas. I'm going to give you a medication that we hope will help you fight the infection. I'll stay here for a bit to make sure you don't have a reaction, okay? He nodded. If everything goes well, we're going to put you into a special stretcher and transport you to the airport. You'll be flown back to Atlanta, where they can give you the best care possible. We're going to do everything we can for you, Lucas. A tear rolled from his yellow, bloodshot right eye onto his cheek. He cleared his throat, looked her in the eye, and said, Thank you. Peyton placed a hand on his shoulder. You're welcome. Lucas had drifted off to sleep when they came to transport him to the airplane. As Dr. Shaw helped him from the bed and into the isolation stretcher, he wanted to stand and hug her. Before she had arrived, he had been sure he would die here. Now he was filled with hope. For the first time since the fever had set in, he believed he had a chance at living. He felt like the luckiest person in the world. At the airport, Peyton watched the air ambulance personnel load Lucas onto the plane, along with the samples Hannah had taken.
You think you'll make it?
Hannah asked.
I hope so, Peyton said.
She glanced at the younger physician. You did great today. Seeing the treatment units firsthand is unnerving. You never get used to it, but it gets a little easier. Chapter 24 Elim Kibet was trying his best to read when Nia Okeke entered the room and marched past the rows of dying villagers. Behind her, a man pushed an empty wheelchair. They stopped before Elim
and Nia squatted down and made eye contact through her clear plastic goggles.
We're moving you, Elim.
He closed the paperback.
To where?
A patient's room has opened up.
Elim's heart sank. It was the answer he had dreaded. If a patient room had opened up, it meant that the young American Lucas Turner had passed away. He tried to stand, but his weakened legs failed him. Hands grabbed him and pulled him into the wheelchair. As he was wheeled out of the room, helpless eyes peered up at him from the floor, but everything passed in haze, as if he were having a nightmare. As he suspected, the wheelchair stopped at the exam room where he had last seen Lucas Turner.
When did he pass? He's not dead. The Americans are flying him home.
Elim looked up, surprised.
That's good. Yes, it is. Now, let's get you into bed.
Nia and the other man helped Elim up, got him settled, and walked out, leaving a cloud of chlorine in their wake. Lying there in silence, Elim thought about how quickly a person's fate could change, how precious life and health are. He had walked into this very room 2 days ago as a practicing physician, a man in control, with the power to heal, looking down on the sick American on the same bed where he himself now lay. He had never known just how different the world looked from the other side. He vowed that if he became well, he would cherish every day. And although he had never wished ill health on another person, there and then he wondered if every physician might benefit from being sick, really sick, just once. He wondered if it would make them all care a little more, or work a little harder, to have been on the other side for a while, to have placed their life and livelihood in the hands of a stranger, even if for only a short period. He had considered himself a very conscientious physician before this, but he imagined that if he lived, he would be even more dedicated to his patients. Staring at the ceiling, he was reminded of an old Indian proverb. A healthy person has 100 wishes, but a sick person has only one. The door opened, and Nia re-entered. She was carrying the 3 buckets Elim knew so well, some bottles of ORS, and a case labeled CDC. She moved to his IV and began attaching something.
What is that?
A gift from our American friends.
What kind of gift?
ZMAP. Elim sat up.
Don't give it to me.
She put a hand on his shoulder, forced him back onto the bed, and sat on the side.
For your sake, it's a good thing you are no longer the physician in charge here, Dr. Kibbet. Give it to someone younger, with their life ahead of them.
Nia smiled at him for the first time.
I like to think you've still got some life ahead of you, Elim. Look, we don't even know if it will help. This is just a trial. We're not dealing with Ebola, so we need a guinea pig to tell us if ZMAP will even work. Someone who understands informed consent. Someone worth saving.
There are lots of people worth saving.
True. We chose you. Now I've got work to do. Call me if you need me.
Before Elim could respond, the woman was gone. As he closed his eyes, he realized that if he survived, he would be immune to whatever the terrible pathogen was. He could help others. He could go back to work without worry. That was something to look forward to. That was something to live for. Chapter 25. 20 miles from the Kenyan border, at a training camp in southern Somalia, a member of the Al-Shabaab terror network turned his smartphone on and opened Daily Nation, Kenya's largest news site. He scoured the stories, looking for opportunities to advance his group's cause. The top headline immediately caught his eye. Outbreak in Mandera. He sat bolt upright when he read the article's subheading. Health workers from the WHO and CDC investigate possible Ebola outbreak in Mandera County. He rushed to the barracks and began waking the members of his cell. They had work to do. Peyton and Jonas sat in the back seat of an SUV, bouncing along the hard-packed red dirt road. The engine roared as they plowed through a cloud of orange dust. There were 6 SUVs in the convoy, plus 2 armored troop carriers, one leading the procession, the other just behind the SUVs, and a Nora B-52 self-propelled artillery vehicle bringing up the rear. Peyton and Jonas had used Dr. Kibbet's notes and the City Forge website to trace Lucas and Stephen's travel route. Based on their interviews with the sick villagers at Mandera Referral Hospital,
as well as what they'd learned from the videos posted online. They had identified a village they believed to be ground zero in the outbreak. They were en route to that village now.
What was that about in the hospital?
Jonas asked.
What?
All the talk about Desmond Hughes? Is he connected to this somehow?
I don't know, Peyton said. She considered telling Jonas about the call from Desmond, but decided against it.
Do you know him, Hughes?
Peyton hesitated.
I used to.
Jonas scrutinized her, as if trying to read through her words.
I think we're missing something here, Peyton said.
Such as?
I don't know yet. Something just doesn't feel right.
You think?
I think someone is responsible for this outbreak.
Bioterror? Here?
I know. There's no strategic, political, or symbolic importance.
Unless...
Jonas thought for a moment.
Unless you wanted to test the pathogen before wider release.
Peyton wanted to continue their conversation, but the car slowed, and the noise from the engine died down. And as the convoy's cloud of dust dissipated, Peyton got her first look at the village. Her mouth ran dry.
Back up, she said, struggling to speak. Tell the other units to keep their distance.
Chapter 26 Transcript CNN Situation Room Segment Good morning and thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour is a deadly outbreak in Kenya. It has already killed dozens, including one American and one British citizen. And anonymous sources at the CDC and State Department say the symptoms are similar to Ebola, though they've cautioned the tests to identify the disease are not yet in. Most alarmingly, CNN has just learned that an infected patient is being transported to the United States as we speak. Authorities at the CDC say that Lucas Turner, a recent graduate of the University of North Carolina, contracted the disease while traveling in northeast Kenya. We'll be updating the story as details unfold, but we want to hear what you think. Should the CDC be bringing patients with an unidentified deadly disease back to the U.S.? Let us know on Twitter using hashtag #OutbreakInAfrica. Chapter 27 When Desmond came to, he was zip-tied to a chair in an airplane. The plane was level. It was apparently at cruising altitude, but it was encountering a fair amount of turbulence. His hands were bound to the armrests, his legs tied below. He opened his eyes just slightly. Across from him, a muscle-bound man with a buzz cut sat gazing at a tablet, white earbuds plugged into his ears. An escape plan took form in Desmond's mind. Keeping his eyes just barely cracked, he began rolling his head around, mumbling. The man pulled out his earbuds and set the tablet aside. His hulking form leaned over Desmond, straining to make out the words. Desmond jerked his head forward, slamming the highest part of his forehead into his captor's face. The soldier fell to the floor in an unconscious heap. Desmond bent forward and bit into the right armrest, trying to tear it open. If he could take out a big enough bite, he could slide his hand free, take the man's gun and... A hand grabbed him by the back of his neck, pulled his head up, and covered his mouth with a cloth. A sweet aroma filled his nose and mouth, and his vision faded to black. Chapter 28 Her first glimpse of the village had spooked Peyton. It was too quiet, too deserted. Something was wrong here, and she feared the worst. She, Jonas, and their team trudged toward the village, all wearing PPE, several members carrying cases with sample collection kits, bottles of ORS, and medications. A white tent complex stood behind them. With the sun setting across the barren red landscape, they looked like space explorers walking on the surface of Mars. Ahead, 24 round huts baked in the last rays of sunlight, their mud-packed walls and thatched roofs weathering the heat. Goats wandered down the village's central road, weaving in and out of red dust clouds drifting in the wind. The first hut was empty, but at the second, Peyton found what she'd expected. Dead bodies. Two adults, likely a man and his wife, lay on their backs. Caked blood covered their faces and chests. Flies swarmed them. Three children lay beside them, two sons and a daughter. Peyton motioned to Hannah, who advanced into the home, set down her cooler, and began taking samples. Peyton knelt by the two adults, swatted away the flies, and searched for clues that might establish a rough time of death. From the looks of it, these bodies had been dead for several days at least. Not good. They found more bodies in the other huts, and several outside. Some of the villagers had probably wanted to die with the sun on their faces or the stars above them. Peyton didn't blame them. Just as she was turning to head back to the tent complex, she caught movement out of the corner of her eye. She froze, waited. Yes, there was someone or something just beyond the village, crouched, watching them. Over the comm, Peyton said, "Jonas, did you see that?" The German epidemiologist was already walking back to the tents. He stopped.
"See that?"
Peyton set down her sample case and got ready to run. It wouldn't be easy in the suit, but taking it off wasn't an option. She spoke quickly on the comm line.
"Colonel Magoro, do you copy?"
"Yes, Dr. Shaw."
"We need a team of your men at my location immediately. Do not transit the village. Proceed around it and use caution. Try to stay out of sight and stay quiet. Have your men take up a concealed position 100 meters north of me."
"Understood,"
the Kenyan officer said.
"Hannah, take your team back to the tents and take off your suits. Get in the vehicles and prepare to leave."
Jonas returned to Peyton's side and glanced over at her, silently questioning what was going on. Peyton nodded subtly toward the bushes. Jonas took a step toward them, but she caught his arm, urging him to wait. A moment later, Colonel Magoro said,
"We're in position."
"Spread your men out and begin walking toward the village," Peyton said.
The Kenyan troops rose, assault rifles held in front of them, and stalked forward quietly, like big game hunters approaching a kill. Peyton wanted to run, but she focused on the group of yellow-green shrubs. If she was wrong about what she had seen, the mistake might be deadly. Sweat poured down her forehead. She desperately wanted to rip the helmet off, wipe her face, and pour cold water in the suit. Suddenly, the bushes between the Kenyan troops and Peyton shook, as three figures sprang forward. A woman, likely in her 40s, a young boy, and a teenage girl, all emaciated. Surviving villagers, Peyton assumed. Their eyes were wild as they barreled toward Peyton and Jonas, away from the soldiers. They stumbled, trying to get their feet under them as they ran. Colonel Magoro and his men were close behind them, yelling in Swahili.
"Don't harm them," Peyton said, "and keep your distance. They may be infected."
15 minutes later, Peyton's team was back at the tent complex. Peyton had placed the three villagers in a field isolation tent just in case they were still infectious. She sat on the other side of a sheet plastic wall, watching the three Kenyans devour the MREs she had given them from her duffel. Though the sun had set, she was still sweating excessively. Colonel Magoro sat beside her, ready to translate. The teenage girl breathed in heavily after finishing the meal in the plastic carton. She looked up at Peyton, and to the physician's surprise, spoke in English.
"Thank you."
"You're welcome," Peyton said.
"What's your name?"
"Halima."
"Halima, can you tell me what happened here?"
The teen glanced toward the village.
"They got sick, coughing, sneezing, like a cold. Then it passed, but everyone got sicker. Started dying, it happened fast."
"Who was coughing and sneezing? Just a few people?"
Halima shook her head.
"Everybody. All of us. All the others."
Peyton pondered her account. If it was true, it would rewrite the pathogenesis of the disease. Whatever the Mandera strain was, it began as a respiratory disease, then progressed into a hemorrhagic fever. It was the ultimate killer, a virus that was highly infectious in the days after contraction, and extremely deadly shortly thereafter. In the distance, she saw a figure suited in PPE advancing toward the village. She rose to find out what was going on, but Jonas was there, leaning against a tent pole, his hand held up.
"It's Hannah. She thought she saw something in Manas' huts. She's going to check it out."
Peyton turned to Magoro.
"Send some men to follow her. Tell them to stay outside the perimeter of the village and to bring night vision goggles."
"Yes, doctor."
Magoro rose and spoke quickly into a handheld radio. Seconds later, 10 men raced from the tent complex toward the village. Peyton held a tablet up to the plastic divider.
"Halima, have you seen any of these 3 men?"
On the screen were pictures of the two American college graduates and the British man. The teenager shook her head. Can you ask the others? Halima spoke in a language Peyton couldn't place. It wasn't Swahili. Perhaps it was a local dialect.
No, they haven't seen them.
Thank you. Can you remember when people began getting sick? When did they die?
Halima consulted the other two villagers.
3 or 4 days ago, maybe.
And the coughing and sneezing. How long ago did that begin? Inside the isolation tent, the three spoke hurriedly, arguing.
We're not sure. Maybe a week, maybe more.
Peyton nodded.
Thank you. You've been very helpful, Halima. The information you've given us may save many lives.
10 minutes later, Hannah marched back into the tent complex carrying a dark object Peyton couldn't make out. Whatever it was, she was taking great care with it. She bagged it before she entered the field decontamination chamber. A short time later, Hannah placed the plastic bag on the conference table. Peyton, Jonas, Millen Thomas, and several members from the Kenyan Ministry of Health leaned forward and examined it. It was a handheld video camera, covered in blood. Hannah took a seat at the table.
They were here, the two Americans.
Good work, Dr. Watson, Peyton said. The young red-headed physician beamed. Peyton pointed to a worn spiral-bound notebook on the table. I've been reviewing Dr. Kibbett's notes. He took a detailed history from Stephen Collins before he died. He also spoke at length with Lucas Turner before we sent him back to Atlanta. Both men reported having a cough, headache, fever, and fatigue a week before Stephen fell ill.
My God, Jonas said.
We're dealing with a completely new, unidentified pathogen here, Peyton said. In the early days, it looks like the flu. A week or two later, it kills you.
So where did it start? Jonas asked.
I see two possibilities, Peyton said. Either it originated here in Kenya, or it was brought here by the Americans.
There's a package from Desmond Hughes,
Jonas said, looking suspicious. Peyton was hesitant. Possibly. Around the table, the Kenyans, Hannah and Millen, glanced at each other, confused. Peyton focused on the head of the Kenyan Ministry of Health team. You sent teams to the surrounding villages where the patients at Mandera Referral Hospital had come from, correct?
We did. It's nothing like this. Some dead. Everyone is sick, though.
Peyton stood and put her hands on her waist. Okay, let's think about what we know. Our index case is likely either Stephen Collins, whose body is in the air on its way back to the CDC, or one of those dead villagers we just saw. Millen, who was a veterinarian, spoke up for the first time. If one of the villagers came into contact with a fruit bat or droppings, the reservoir hosts might be close by. At the end of the table,